Hello, Story Seekers. I'm Ben.
I'm Nico, and you're listening to The Tiny Bookcase.
Our guest for this episode is an American storyteller and YouTuber with a passion for the juicy tales from history.
His channel, Dates and Dead Guys, affirms that history is more than just that. We'd like to warmly welcome Miles Fisher.
Hello, Miles.
Hello. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you for coming on. Yeah, it's absolutely our pleasure. I've been ranting and raving to Nico about your YouTube channel since I discovered it, and basically anyone else that will listen, because it's so close to my heart, this idea of finding the interesting anecdotes and tales from history and communicating what happens in history through storytelling. I've always loved doing it. I've always loved nonfiction and historical fiction around it, so I think it's a really good thing that you're doing.
No, the growth of the channel recently has been awesome. So to get reached out to by people like you guys has been very reaffirming to me and exciting.
I'm really glad it's happening for you. I mean, I did see that the views on them have absolutely exploded. So clearly you've hit the zeitgeist, I think. So in your professional opinion as a historical storyteller, what makes an anecdote exciting?
So there has to be a number of things. So I would say initially there has to be something kind of unique about the story that you're going to tell, or something compelling. You know, there are, you know, not, I think, that many real things that people identify with. So people can identify with survival, or they can identify with love, or they can identify with any kind of primal urge that you put out there. And history is full of all those kinds of things that people can relate to, even if their own lives are less dramatic.
I think that's what makes it so cool, your stuff, because it does make historic people feel like people, and that's where stories are cool. I think that's, you've hit something there that I hadn't thought of it like that before, but
absolutely. I fully agree. It's the idea of like finding the things for people to connect to. Is so important. I mean, from my own sort of educational experience, I've lost track of the amount of times that I just lost the thread when someone was just regurgitating basically from a textbook at me, or, you know, there are so many uninteresting ways to communicate history, but the teachers that I remember are the teachers that communicated things to me anecdotally. And I don't know whether that's my particular brain.
Oh, no, that's... Oh no, that's 100% where I'm coming from. So in my day job, so I'm a history teacher, and so, you know, I teach history. I've been in middle school for most of the last 10 years, and the reason why I want to become a history teacher is because I had some wonderful teachers throughout middle school and high school that were excellent storytellers and could really draw me in. And you know, I find that it's an art that I try to share with my students as much as possible. And just over the last about year and a half, I've just kind of taken it to YouTube and seeing what I could do with it.
I think it's fantastic. I think it's really exciting that you're doing it.
I'm pretty excited for you to share it with us.
Yes, we'll be having a tale shortly.
Yeah, which the stories do beckon, gents, so we better crack on. Our regular listeners will know how it goes, but for those of you joining us for the first time, there will be three stories told in this episode. Where this episode will be a little different is that Miles will be telling us a true tale from history for us to get our teeth into. Our prompt has been drawn from Miles' tale, and that prompt is Wingman. Ben, fire away.
Wingman. Tell them I'm dead. Zufar whispered to Azat, remaining as still as he could. Things had been bad since the massacre at Batak. 2 years of lingering evil memories. Now the Bulgarians had them, and their vengeance would be swift. Zufar had never been able to get his mouth around Bulgarian words, not even to find a way to apologize. His brother-in-arms, Azat, leaned back against him as though craning to look at his face, before shouting urgently at the men who guarded them. The Bulgarians laughed, and one threw his ale at Zufar. He didn't flinch, as the cup bounced off his ear, nor did he shudder as the sour ale dripped down his face into his greying moustache. Zufar knew they were sat near the edge of the Bulgarian Legion's encampment, and it sounded like the victory celebrations were underway. A slender hope had bloomed for Zufar, but it was undeniable the odds were loaded against them this time. They were each bound at the wrists, and another rope looped under their arms to keep them upright with their backs to each other. Azat's broad frame held him up as Zufar remained motionless, having sagged against the ropes. The ground was covered in small pebbles which pressed into the backs of his legs painfully, but he did not dare to shift his position. He heard them coming, scattering the little stones with their soldier's stroll. There was a sudden poke at his chest as one of them prodded him with their bayonet. The tip of it pierced his crimson felt jacket and pressed through the red silk shirt underneath. The man muttered some words, and Zufar made out only one of them, Batak. He remembered that it had been a dark day. Black clouds had slunk across the storm-stained ether, hiding them from the sun. The town of Batak had been strong once. It was surrounded by wooded hills that were thick with pine and spruces, and teemed with game. The hills leant against the mountains, which seemed in turn to hold back the horizon, giving the town an almost liminal quality that Zufar would never forget. Rebellion, uprising, it hadn't mattered to Zufar what the Ottomans claimed was happening. All he had known was that he and the other crazies were being unleashed under the supervision of a madman. Bashi Basuks, the Ottomans called them. Irregular soldiers for an empire that had expanded beyond sense and strayed into violent insanity. They were dangerous men and paid with the promise of plunder. The town of Batak, seeing thousands of rapacious Bashi Basuks strolling out of their woods, had requested parley. Zufar had stood nearby as the Ottoman leader, Ahmet Aga, spoke with the representative from Batak, a man named Kerilov. They agreed to a ceasefire if the town disarmed themselves and gave their weapons over. It was a lie. Once they were disarmed, Ahmet Aga ordered Kerilov seized. His eyes and teeth were pulled from his head, and then the general commanded that a fire be lit so they could kebab the man. Zufar had pushed an old iron-tipped spear through the wailing man's back until the rusted point burst from his bloody mouth. The smell of Kerilov's flesh roasting over Ahmet's fire rapidly suffused the town. It was a signal to begin the slaughter. Azat had been with him, but had begun to vomit uncontrollably at the stench, and Zufar had left him to chase after a local woman he had spied who wore a fine dress. He had jogged after her, taking careful aim so as to not ruin the red silk of her dress, which he would later have cut and sewn into a shirt for himself. The other crazies chopped their way into Batak and savagely raided house after house, leaving only screams and death in their wake. Zufar had been amongst the first of the Bashi Basuks that managed to break into the church, the town's last refuge. Hundreds of women had tried to fight them as their children cowered behind the wooden pews. Zufar had truly lost himself in the blood then. He still remembered every stroke of his sword as he butchered them. When it was done, he had sat by the broken door and watched the room of corpses for a time. Over 5,000 townsfolk died that day. Since then, Azat had grown wealthy, investing the coins they had plundered back home, and Zufar knew what awaited his friend after the war was comfort, perhaps even peace, in the arms of a wife. Zufar loved and hated him for that. His own plunder had gone on paid companionship, strong raki, and numbing shisha. All to push Batak into his distant past as quickly as he could. Time had passed, but the memories had refused to fade. 2 years later, the Ottomans had lost control of the vital Shipka Pass in the mountains near Batak, and the Bulgarian Legion had been the ones to end their hopes of victory, killing many and capturing the disposable Bashi Basuks. Their revenge, they must have thought, was at hand. Zufar opened his eyes as he felt the heat of the Bulgarian soldier's breath on his face. The man's eyes widened in shock just before Zufar's teeth sank into his nose. The soldier screamed, trying to pull away. Zufar stood with him, aided by Azat's strength, which pushed him from the rear. He leant all his weight onto the bayonet the man still held to his chest. The point carved him, but in doing so, it split the rope that was across their chests. There was a moment of horrid constriction as Azat strained at their shared bond. Horror surged through Zufar as his fear told him that the big man might crack his ribs. Then the rope snapped and the two Bashi Basuks stepped apart. Zufar heard the second guard tackle Azat, but had no time to look behind him as he kicked his Bulgarian to the ground and spat the chunk of nose away. Zufar knelt swiftly and pulled out the small knife he kept in his curved boot, turning it deftly to cut the bonds which held his wrists. The noseless man was trying to get up, but Zufar stabbed him in the throat as he did so, wrenching the small blade to open the wound wide before pulling it out. Azat had trampled his captor, but his hands were still bound, and a third soldier had rushed towards the sounds of fighting, his bayonet affixed to his rifle, and held ahead of him like a spear. Zufar rushed to Azat's back and cut him free. He watched as the big man spread his arms to accept the charge from the last nearby Bulgarian. Azat pushed the bayonet off to one side with one hand and brought the other scything around in a huge open-handed slap. For years, Azat had trained that clap by slapping wet marble, and that hardened hand crashed into the Bulgarian's face, nearly knocking his head from his shoulders. Zufar heard something snap, and the man fell dead at Azat's feet, head lolling backwards on his broken neck. The camp, which had been reveling in the Legion's victory, was growing wise to their escape, and Zufar could hear warning shouts spreading from tent to tent. The two men said nothing to each other, but instead ran headlong towards the edge of the encampment. There they slid behind a large boulder, which hid them from view for a moment. Rocky ridges sprawled on either side of the path, which would lead them down to the Shipka Pass below and the safety of the Ottoman camp. They would struggle to reach it on foot if the Bulgarians pursued them, and the sounds of the camp indicated that a large force was mustering to recapture the two escaped Bashi Basuks. Zufar looked up at his massive brother-in-arms.
"Head down to the pass. I'll lead them over the ridge."
Azat stared at him, realizing that Zufar did not mean to see the other side of the day. He opened his mouth to protest, but Zufar cut him off with a hug, then spoke into the big man's ear.
"Azat, I will see you tomorrow, or I will see you in hell. Either will suffice. Marry and live well, my friend."
With that, he pushed himself up and began to pick his way along the ridge which led west, taking care to be as obvious as he could. After a moment, the report of rifles crackled behind him. The shots missed him, but shattered against the jutting rock at his feet, sending up chips of stone and fractured lead, which bit into him in a dozen places. Zufar hobbled along after that, feeling the little wounds trickling blood inside his clothes. He surged on, leading them away from Azat, and eventually hunkered down in a ravine. Bulgarian shouts of pursuit echoed around him. Zufar grimaced as a dark stain of one of the deeper wounds began to spread through his stolen shirt. He considered praying, but soon dismissed the idea. What god would save a man like him?
I thoroughly enjoyed that one, man.
Yeah? It's been a while since I did a bit of historical fiction, isn't it?
I mean, I've got two historians here. I feel so spoiled.
I'm not a historian.
Something actually from history.
No, that was a lot of fun to listen to. Especially, you definitely feel the tension rise as it went on, and how connected the two were throughout the story.
It was something that in an early draft I actually found to be quite problematic, because I was trying to like really encourage that thing that you've just said, which is, you know, you can feel the connection between the two men. But it was quite whiplash. I was like jumping back and forth between their perspectives. And eventually I just settled on keeping it to Zufar's perspective, sort of third person limited-ish.
Yeah, I think that's the right call there.
Yeah.
Especially in something short where you can't let it breathe a little bit. You just kind of have to go in on the sights and sounds of one.
Absolutely. But so there's a couple of things in here that I'd really like to talk about. The first is that big slap, that big bastard slap that he did.
So I was just about to say the like slapping the marble thing was really cool.
Yeah. So I'm fairly sure this is apocryphal. But this idea of an Ottoman slap, it does sort of get sort of spoken about here and there, with reports of it being, you know, these guys basically being able to like knock people out or kill them, even like stun a horse in one instance, I think.
I'll be honest, mate, it sounds like a sex move.
It does, doesn't it? The Ottoman slap, yeah.
She gave me the old Ottoman slap.
That is actually not one that I have heard of before. The Ottoman slap. Now, that the imagery that you used to define it, the idea of slapping the marble first and the impact that it had on the guy, was you know, you could picture it in your head. Whether or not someone's neck is going to snap from that is something I would pause about. But a knock unconscious for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's you know, I already, like, even from the bits of reading that I did around that, people were really throwing cold water on it quite quickly. But I thought, you know, what if I have the guy running at him and I make sure that Azat is this big beast of a man, and, you know, I've sort of done the legwork to make it almost work. But I agree with you, in all honesty. I don't think that's possible.
But there is actually a history of a martial art in that region too called Pancration that does a lot of, like, open hand attacks. So it's not even entirely unreasonable to assume that people are adept at that, you know, and that's you know, something relatively common.
That's wicked. I hadn't heard about this. So is this like a sort of Greco-Turkish kind of wrestling?
I would have to. I don't want to misspeak on it a little bit, yeah. But it was a big thing, especially you know, at the same time of the rise of MMA in the 1990s. There was a separate branch before that called Pancration, and you have a lot of Eastern Europeans taking part of it. So I would assume it's from there, but I don't know for sure.
Fair enough. No, that makes sense.
You know what it put me in mind of? I know it's slightly tangential, but have you seen these like slap fights that are a thing now?
Oh, yeah. They make me cringe, man. They're horrid.
People like stood directly opposite each other, just really belting each other. And there's fucking rules. Like, oh, you're not allowed to flinch. Really? That man is like 6'9" and he's about to hit me in the face. I'm going to flinch.
No, I'm about a bigger fan of MMA as you can be, but that stuff... you're entirely defenseless. I'm not here for it.
It's a bit like old-fashioned dueling, isn't it, with pistols, where one person gets to shoot first and you just have to stand there and take it.
Even that, though, was largely based on honor in a lot of cases. I mean, the vast majority of duels never hurt anybody. It was mostly about being brave enough to face your enemy.
Oh, that's so cool. See, we cannot just throw this off the top of our head. You've actually got the facts to back it up. That's so cool. the second thing that I quite liked the idea of here, and this I read about these guys about a month or two ago and decided at some point that I was going to write a story about them, were these Bashi Basuks, these just crazy dudes. My understanding is that the name means something like head turned or like crazy head. And essentially they're land pirates. The Ottoman Empire didn't arm them, didn't give them a uniform, didn't pay them, and just said, you know, we'll almost like a privateer getting a letter of marque, you know, just go and mess up that bit of the world. Take what you can from the civilians, kill people, generally harass, you know, lines of communication, lines of supply. And I think they were basically terrifying, this huge irregular part of this Ottoman Empire machine that was essentially just geared around plunder from the lands that they were trying to take.
Well, that is the way that history ran for an extended period of time. It was one of the ways that you got people to agree to, you know, any sort of military service that wasn't entirely mandatory. It was that it was going to be profitable for them by going.
And are you aware of, like, people having, like, a base? Like, if they signed up, would they be like, I will get a minimum amount of plunder, or were they just rolling the dice on where the
So different places will do things wildly differently. Like you'll hear stories of the Mongols, for example, where they would do everything under a very strict honor system to spread out the loot they got about as evenly as possible. And that was one of the things that kept whoever was in control, was that they were viewed honorable and fair because they would give out loot. But under the Romans, for example, it wasn't nearly that strict. It was just kind of, you were more likely to get people to follow you if you shared your plunder, even though it may not be quite as even.
I think I'm only thinking about this now, but we had such a similar system, except it would be, you know, land and titles as opposed to physical plunder, right?
I guess, like, you know, if you conquer land and then people are signed up and maybe they get like a bit of land to farm or something. Yeah,
you get nice.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. I would include that in plunder is land and actually, oftentimes the conquered were slaves, the people who conquered them.
Oh, it's fascinating. And just the last thing, because you know this, I really wanted to push like a bit of historical fiction into this episode because you're here, Miles, and I'm already 100% glad that I did that because your feedback's been fantastic and your knowledge on it is so great. But this massacre, this Batak massacre, so this actually happened, and it's in a way it's worse than what I've written here. With just people like the dude getting kebabbed. That's I haven't taken any liberties there. The commander said kebab this man, and they kebabbed him. And then they would just
now,
go on, sorry.
And now, forgive me for interrupting you here. So I'm not familiar with the specific event. What year did this happen?
So this was in 1876. So this story roughly takes place you know, the sort of like the present day of the story is in 1878, which is towards the end of the Russo-Turkish War.
Okay.
This Bulgarian legion that I mentioned, they essentially, through like a heroic feat of arms, held a really important pass in the Balkan Mountains against, you know, I think 5,000 of them against about 30,000 Ottomans, including some Bashi Basuks. So that's the victory that's happened here. But then 2 years earlier, one of the things that's really riled up the Bulgarians is that they initially sort of rose up against the Ottoman overlords in 1876, so 2 years earlier, and the town of Batak was quite an influential town, and it was sort of a bit of a hub for supplies for the rebels and things like that. And essentially the Ottomans, as I've sort of said in the story, just gave a mad general 5,000 crazy Bashi Basuks and just said, go and sort them out. So they turned up at this this town, lied to them about a ceasefire and a you know, putting down their arms, and then killed roughly somewhere between 5,000 and 8,000 of them, which was like 90% of the town's population, including lots of women and children, like kids getting like butchered to pieces whilst like the mothers are still holding them. And the church was just filled with corpses because that's where they sort of made their final stand, and they were just butchered where they stood. And I believe there's now like a really grim ossuary of those bones still in Batak, in that old church.
Good Lord.
That is horrifying.
It's absolutely horrifying.
It's one of those things that when you take a look at, you know, 1800s isn't exactly an ancient world, but when you take a look at a lot of the old writings, especially prior to World War I, a lot of warfare gets really romanticized. And you can see that a ton of things generally get left out of the details that in the last 200 years, we've been definitely a little bit more privy to. And the big one is just kind of like what goes on in the shadows. You know, you'll read all these accounts of people encountering towns and going in for plundering, and you hear about the combat between soldiers and men. But you have to remember that women and children live there too. And even if they're not written about oftentimes, they are in the shadows. They are there. And these are not the civil times we live in now. It is a little bit different.
Absolutely. And one of the reasons that this is quite a famous massacre is because it was actually uncovered by, I believe, an American and a British journalist. I'd need to double check the names on that one, but they essentially popularized it, so in order to expose the atrocities that were happening underneath Ottoman rule. And it eventually did lead to, it was part of the reason that a lot of the allies of the Ottomans turned against their the way that they were managing Bulgaria. So it's interesting that you bring that up as this, like, you know, these things aren't often spoken about, whereas this one was, like, journalists got involved in this in 1876 and mm-hmm. and really let people know exactly how horrifying it was in order to change the world a bit. Not necessarily for the better, but one would hope so. Anyway, I've really enjoyed this chat about it, but should we move along to your non-fiction tale?
I'm ready when you are.
Let's do it. Let's have it.
Let's go.
Okay. My wingman story is going to be a bit of a tonal change, but we'll see that as we go. It's called the Lakota Love Story. Let's begin. The Black Hills of South Dakota rise from the neighboring Great Plains. They are a desirable land of plenty, home of the buffalo and home of the Lakota, as well as their neighboring rivals like the Crow. Countless legendary warriors from the Lakota, identified by their large feathered headdresses, are remembered. Names like Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, and Red Cloud. They are warriors and raiders, legendary for defending their land and providing for their tribe and family. But there is more to life than buffalo hunts and war parties. Some just want to find love. And to find love as a Lakota, you have to do things a little differently. High Horse is a young Lakota man. He doesn't come from one of the great families in his tribe, but he is nice enough, handsome and fit, but he is a bit floundering, happy to follow, but without signs of aspiring greatness. He has fallen for a beautiful young girl in his tribe. He has hardly ever spoken to her, but she is very pretty and from a good family. He knows she will make a great wife. As a Lakota man, if you want to begin courting a young woman, your choices are pretty limited. There are some traditions. For example, he could play for her a courting flute. They take effort to make, but mimic the bugle of a bull elk during rut. It is very alluring. Then, if she likes him, he could talk to her parents. But that's risky, and a High Horse takes a different route. This girl's parents are very protective. He can't be so brash as to flute for her. They would put a stop to the courting right away. No, he loves her. To talk to her and win her over, he needs to be cunning. That night, he sneaks up to her teepee and waits for her to come out. But she doesn't. As day breaks, High Horse is forced to retreat as to not be seen. Discouraged, he tells his friend and cousin, Red Deer. They decide on another course of action. In the day, he will wait by the stream where she goes to fetch water as part of her chores and hide in the bushes. People don't go down there very often. Most don't want to offend the water spirit. They fear it, but it has never bothered the two boys. High Horse says to Red Deer, "When she comes by, if no one is looking, then I will jump out and hold her and make her listen to me. If she likes me too, I can tell that by the way she acts, for she is very bashful and may not say a word or even look at me the first time." Amazingly, the plan worked. High Horse caught her by the stream and he felt like it went very well. He later says to Red Deer, "She didn't say anything. She might really like me." So High Horse goes to see the girl's father. He is an elder in the tribe. The girl is his only child. For the Lakota, if a man is ready to marry a woman, he needs to offer her father a dowry. On the High Plains, in the land of the buffalo hunters, horses are the greatest form of payment. When High Horse approaches the girl's father, he confesses his love for her. He offers her father two horses. It is all he has. But without a word, the old man waves him away. High Horse is crushed. He feels physically ill. He doesn't know what to do. Red Deer finds High Horse in a dejected state. To help his friend, he offers to give him both of his horses to increase the dowry. High Horse is beyond grateful. He promises to pay Red Deer back after they go on the warpath again. With some confidence, High Horse goes back to the old man, now with four horses. But without a word, he is waved away again. High Horse pleads with the old man. Surely four horses has to be enough. There is hardly another young man who can give him much more than that in the tribe. But the old man doesn't speak. He just stands there in stoic silence, and High Horse knows he hasn't changed his mind. He leaves, depressed. He knows four horses are all he can get. He feels so sick he is going to die, and he has lost his appetite. Aimlessly, he goes to sulk in the forest. After not too long, by chance, he sees the girl walking by. He thinks it must be fate. He grabs her again and begs her to run away with him, but she says no, that she will not run away with him, because she wants to be bought like a fine woman. High Horse Hope turns to despair. He lets her go and he leaves. He doesn't know what to do. He is more lovesick than he has ever been. He can't eat. He can hardly sleep. He can't buy the woman he loves, and she will not run away with him. All he can think about is giving up. It kills him because he knows that all the Lakota that people tell stories about would never have done that. They were good for something. High Horse can't even win over a girl or her father. He feels worthless. Red Deer can't stand to see his friend this way. He rallies him with a speech, saying to High Horse, "She will not run away with you. Her old man will not take four horses, and four horses are all you can get. You must steal her and run away with her. Then, after a while, you can come back, and the old man cannot do anything because she will be your woman." High Horse looks at Red Deer unconvinced, but he adds, "Probably she wants you to steal her anyway." High Horse thinks that maybe she does. Besides, that might be his only reasonable option, so he agrees. That night, late, they sneaked up to the teepee of the girl's family and waited until it sounded as if the old man, her mother, and the girl were asleep. Then High Horse crawled under the teepee with a knife. The knife isn't to do harm to her father. Rather, it's because the father isn't a dummy. He has spoken to High Horse. He has seen him sneaking around. Knowing that kidnapping for love is an option, he ties his daughter down at night with leather straps to keep her safe. The plan is to cut her free, drag her out of the teepee, gag her, because in all of her excitement she may not be quiet, and then throw her on a horse to hightail it out of there. But before that can happen, High Horse notices cutting the straps is harder than he anticipated. His knife is dull. He makes it through a couple of the straps, but as he struggles to cut the last one, the blade slips, and by mistake, he slices the girl's leg. She screams, alerting everyone within shouting distance. With one nervous cut, the plan is ruined. Before they know what happened, High Horse sneaks out of the teepee. It is dark, and in the middle of the night, he and Red Deer are chased by the old man and some of the warriors in nearby teepees, but in the chaos, they are narrowly able to escape. No one for sure knew it was them. In the morning, the young men sit by the stream outside the village. High Horse feels so ill and lovesick he just wants to die. Nothing has worked. He hasn't slept or eaten in days. Red Deer hates to see his friend this way. While looking at the stream, he comes up with another plan. He jumps up and says, "I am sure if you are man enough, we can steal her this time." Desperate for help, before even hearing the plan, High Horse agrees. Red Deer then has High Horse stripped down naked. He paints him solid white with black stripes down his body. Black rings are painted around his eyes. He looks like a water spirit, the one everyone fears. Red Deer tells High Horse that he looks terrible, scary even to him, and that if you get caught again, everyone will be so scared they will think that you are a bad spirit. They will be afraid to chase you. Other than the spirit paint, the plan is exactly the same. So that night, they sneak back into the girl's teepee. High Horse crawls in with a now sharpened knife, and Red Deer hangs out outside with some horses, ready to gag her when High Horse drags her out. As he's cutting one of the tighter straps, it pops, and the girl's mother wakes up. It's dark. She can't see, but she thinks someone is there. She tries to wake her husband, but he's not having it and falls back to sleep. To be safe, High Horse lays low and still. But before he's confident the mother is sleeping again, his mind wanders, and after days of restlessness, he nods off. Outside the teepee, Red Deer waits, but hours go by and daybreak comes. He leaves as to not be seen. With the morning light illuminating the inside of the teepee, the girl wakes up. Still tied down, she turns her head. There, she sees, laying next to her, a big white striped animal. She screams, Everyone wakes up, and again, a high horse has to run. He escapes down to the creek and hides in a hollow tree. Those who gave chase gave up quickly. They were content that the water spirit had returned to the creek. When the coast is clear, Red Deer goes again to find his friend. Upset at failing again, High Horse elects not to return to the village. But this time, Red Deer sees something else in him. His friend is not despondent. He is sad and embarrassed, but now there is something else. High Horse says he's going to go on the warpath. He is tired of being lovesick and hungry. He is going to clear his mind. Red Deer, ever the friend, doesn't miss a beat, and the two start walking toward enemy territory. They travel for a few days, and one night at sundown, they come across a village, Crows, the arch rival of the Lakota. Wary of raids, scouts would usually warn the tribe of incoming war parties, but the two boys remain undetected. Just outside the village, they find a single Crow warrior guarding all the tribe's horses. They think there must be 100. Red Deer wants to be cautious, but High Horse, reflecting on his passive nature, isn't willing to be so careful. What has being timid gotten him? With the stealth of sneaking into a girl's teepee, he approaches the guard and kills him. Before daybreak, they make off with the horses. They fled with the herd for 3 days, driving them quickly back to their own village as fast as they could. When they get there, it is morning on the third day. With a sense of accomplishment, High Horse drives the herd right outside the teepee of the old man and the girl that he loves. Hearing the commotion, the old man rises from his teepee. The first thing he sees is a massive herd and High Horse walking directly up to him. Standing upright and confident, High Horse says, "Is this enough horses for me to marry your daughter?" The old man looks back, and after a moment he smiles and says, "You may marry my daughter, but it was not the horses I wanted. All I wanted was a son that was a real man and good for something."
That's it. It was so engaging.
I feel like I've had times in my life where I have been High Horse, and I have had times when I have been Red Deer. And I regret none of it. that was great.
It's really fun. It's such a lovely... Exactly what you say, like, history is more than dates and dead guys. Like, you brought these people to life. You make High Horse, you know, his pain at not being good enough, like, that transposes really easily to the modern day. And, you know, Red Deer, just an absolute bro. A little bit misguided at times, maybe. Like, the water spirit idea seems like it may have even been, like, a joke.
That's me when I'm Red Deer.
Yeah.
No. No, this story comes from an excerpt of a book called Black Elk Speaks. Black Elk was a Lakota medicine man, and that version is quite a bit longer. He says in the book itself that like, he himself didn't know High Horse or Red Deer, but the story had been passed down from generations. But there's a ton of layers to it that really makes it stand out to me. The first one being here that the overall message of the story just being that in order to get something you really want, you kind of have to make yourself worth something. Yeah. And, you know, and it wasn't until High Horse kind of threw off his sad, dejected self and went and made himself worthy that he was able to win the girl. But without a true friend kind of pushing him the entire way, you know, he probably never would have made it. And we all kind of need people to help us out.
So there's a degree of being it being didactic then. Do you think... This was a useful story for the Lakota for it to be passed down. It's like, go and make something of yourself, and brotherhood is important.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's a case with, I think, a ton of legends throughout a vast number of societies. You know, if it doesn't have some sort of truth to it or value, it kind of fades aside, especially in civilizations that don't have standardized writing systems.
And the way that it was actually written down, so Black Elk Speaks, so I'm assuming that somebody met Black Elk and then he told stories to them and then they wrote them down, or did Black
Elk...
Yep,
that's exactly it. So yeah. So Black Elk was famously part of the Indian Wars in the 1860s, 70s. He was right, like, I'm not sure how much you guys know in the UK in regards to Native American history in the US, but One of the most famous battles was at Little Bighorn, when American General Custer, his entire army got ridden on by hundreds of Lakota and absolutely decimated. And so he was a witness to a ton of acts like that one that happened in Lakota history. And much later, after the American Indians were forced to reservation, some very intelligent people knew to go sit down with them and get their stories before many of them passed on. And his book's one of the more famous ones.
Okay. Some of the cultural stuff in it is, it's almost like mind-blowing. This idea that, what I'll do is I'll go and I'll just grab hold of her, and her reaction will tell me whether she wants to marry me. But her eventual response of, no, I want to buy me like a real man. Like, it's so cool to see. I mean, obviously, don't try that now, kids, if you're listening. And there's, you got a crush on someone at school. Don't be like, I know, I shall seize her in the night. Don't do that.
Right.
But it's really interesting for that to have been the cultural norm,
Yeah, absolutely. And this was very common. You have groups like this, and people don't always know how to think about Native Americans, but it's like the tribal dynamics are very, very complicated. So you have these massive groups that break up into other bands. And these bands, even though they're of a similar culture, aren't always connected. And so, there might be warfare between groups of Lakota. There might be warfare between groups of Crow. They might kidnap people from each other. And then, usually with women and children, they would kind of raise them as their own. And there are some practical elements to that, too, that kind of made it normal within society, which is that in order to, make new warriors, you need, about 16 years, because that's usually around the age where people became warriors. People don't exactly, you can't repopulate quickly. So kidnappings and the cultures around kidnappings were far different than what we see today.
Mm. That's fascinating.
It really is. I really enjoyed the line about, in all the excitement, she may not be quiet. So is that you injecting some sort of tongue-in-cheek humor there, or is that Black Elk?
So it's a little bit of both. I haven't read the book since a year ago when I originally adapted it for the story. But that is the tone of the story. When you hear Black Elk telling the story, that's the idea from the perspective of High Horse, is that, she's going to like this. Okay. Once she sees my point of view, she's going to be very excited that I did this for us. And that's his perspective. Again, a very different culture than what we have now.
Yeah. Yeah. But, again, it's sort of like, I'm thinking about more modern movies and sort of Hollywood movies and stuff, like, the husband making a really large purchase and then having to tell his wife, it's sort of got that vibe to it a little bit as well, hasn't it? Like, mm-hmm. So yeah, I'll just do this. It'll be fine. And
yeah.
And I'm sure she'll be fine with that. I'm sure there won't be any knockback for it. I have another follow-up question, which is about the war spirit. So would it have been a bit irreverent to dress up to paint up like a war spirit? Or was that, that spirit paint, was that a fairly common thing to do?
So war paint was very common. And, I would have to go back and do some research on what it is. But they would also use paint for a lot of different ceremonies. And for different ceremonies, they might dress up like spirits. They also had different depictions of what different spirits would look like. And in the case of the water spirit specifically, that was supposed to be white. It was actually, so the language that they shared was shared by a lot of different tribes in the region, even though each different tribe had slightly different dialects. Mm-hmm. And, we were actually kind of lucky enough to have some depictions down. And so if anyone wanted to know what they thought that the water spirit really looked like, they could just Google Winnebago water spirit. And there's some illustrations online that are kind of goofy.
Excellent. Oh, I think it's a fascinating story. I really enjoyed it.
I'm really glad it was a water spirit, by the way, because when you were saying about, white and black paint, I was like, is he painting himself with stripes? Is he making himself into a skeleton? Is that... That's where my brain went. So maybe I would have sucked as a Native American. I guess that's what I'm saying.
No, well, it's one of those things that, like, when you're reading the story, like, you know, like if I was writing fiction, I want to make it this way. It's not the way I would do it, but like to make the change seems disrespectful. So you just kind of keep it as it is.
I tell you what, I want one of those courting flutes that sound like a rutting bull. That sounds neighbors, doesn't it?
Oh yeah. Well, there's actually a second part of that ceremony, which is kind of funny. So after you play the courting flute, and it's pretty loud, so that catches people's attention. She's gonna like your flute, of course. It sounds like an elk. But now that everyone's paying attention, these groups don't have a lot going on in their daily life, so they're nosy. You want some privacy. There was a different ceremony called wrapped up in a blanket, and it's literally just what it sounds like. Like, so with all these like onlookers, as you're trying to like talk to the girl to get some privacy, you just wrap her up in a blanket so no one can like see you, and that's supposed to be your privacy while there's just like a ton of people outside like poking at the blanket. Like, what's going on in there?
I love that. Oh, fantastic.
Oh, top notch. I really enjoyed that. Thank you for telling us that. But I think it's probably time for our third and final tale of the episode. So, Nico.
Oh, no.
Let's have it.
If I must, then I must. The Wingman. God felt, broadly speaking, he'd absolutely smashed it on days 1 through 5. On day 1, when he'd made light and, as a byproduct he'd forever claim was planned, the darkness, it felt like this was gonna be a good one. He'd paused briefly to make angels then. Something seemed off about the sensation of inventing something as, in his words, fundamental and incredible, as light, without a small group to say things like, "Wow, that was really impressive," and give a smattering of applause. Thus had he made his collective of assistants and put them to work, standing nearby and shouting encouraging bravos. He'd knocked out the sky on day 2, which was pretty good by all accounts, if a bit vague and empty. He'd wondered if it would matter that the blue bit only went a certain distance, and after that it was freezing cold death, but there wasn't anyone around to notice. Day 3, he put some work in on the primary orb. The backup orbs, a small hot one, huge gas one, diamond rain nonsense sphere, they'd be something he might get to later. This Earth one was a good jumping off point, even without rearranging all the celestial bollocks he'd scattered about early on. He made some bits wet, covered it in green things that were, he'd call it, alive. A good word. The angels agreed, because this new word described the manner in which they intended to remain. On day 4, he started getting a bit weird with it. He made the sun, which sort of ruined his whole day 1 thing. It was making a lot of light on its own. This irritated him, and when the angels weren't looking, he turned the first light off, as though he'd planned the whole thing. He enjoyed the sun, so he made billions more of them, and sort of chucked them about. Then he made a load of smaller rocks, because he was knackered. "What will you do tomorrow, O Lord?" asked an angel named Lucifer. God made a note to spread nasty rumours about that one, putting him on the spot like that. "I'll make living beings for the wet bit and the sky bit, I reckon," said God. He was overextending himself, he knew, but nothing if not a showman. Late into the night he worked to make a new sort of angel who could help him on the next day. He made one who could fold bits of flesh so thin that water would pass through and leave air behind, and he called him the Gill Man. Another he made, who could make flat bits that let his creations flap about until they weren't stuck to the dry bits of earth anymore, and he called him the Wing Man. Day 5 went off with a bang. Concepts flew left and right as God and his two little helpers worked like the clappers. "Behold," said God, just in case any of the rapt angels weren't beholding properly yet. He pointedly stared at Lucifer. He hated that mouthy little shit. "Another fish." The angels cooed appreciatively. "Looks an awful lot like that cod one you did earlier," Lucifer muttered. God grumbled and drew a line on its side. "Well, now it doesn't. It's a haddock. What is it?" "A haddock," the angels chorused back, Lucifer's voice dragging a little bit behind. The wingman tapped God's shoulder and handed something across. "Behold!" cried God again to the beholding crowd. He squinted at this newest bird. "A blue tit." A couple of angels stifled a laugh, though to God's credit, it was blue where its lack of tits were. God stared pointedly at Lucifer, willing them to say something about the name. Lucifer bit its tongue and invented both whistling and the concept of nonchalance. God rued the rubbish name and sent the bird on its way. Thus it was for the rest of day 5. He ran the gillman and the wingman ragged, at one point even holding up something that quick thinking left him calling the flying fish. God went to bed feeling extremely smug. It was justified, but didn't make him any less unbearable. When day 6 started, God had a plan preloaded. He'd start with a few simple bits. "Today, we are making land animals, and I have something special planned." "Ooh," said the angels. God frowned. That had been a bit of a trick. Everything he did was special, and they'd proved, with their inane oohing, that they didn't think so. Bastards, he thought. Probably all that little shit Lucifer. Well, I'll show them. God decided the special thing would have to be extremely special, so he thought hard about what it could be. What was the most special thing that he could think of? That was the question. He mused on it as he made the beasts of the land. His ta-das were a bit quieter as he held aloft the horse, the zebra, and then the giraffe. No one dared to say, "Well, that's just the same one, but stripy." And no one even considered saying, "Well, bugger me, I think you've got some wrong bits on that one. That's definitely snake from the head to the shoulder. It's got leopard print on it." Even as God continued to pick up bits from the wrong piles and slot them together, the angels cooed graciously. When he held out a strange creature, low to the ground, clearly half beaver, they gave their normal smattering of applause. The wingman didn't even complain that half the bits he'd been using to perfect duck had been nicked in the process. Instead, he redoubled his speed in order to keep up. And then the idea struck God. "Aha!" he said aloud, for on day 6 that was quite an original thing to do. The angels leant in, and he said, "I am prepared to begin work on my most special creation now. It shall be based on the most wondrous, brilliant, and handsome thing I know." The angels cooed appreciatively, and God began working on a creation based on the most wondrous, brilliant, and handsome thing he could think of. Himself. He used chimp for the basic framework, shielding his angels from that fact and hoping that no one would notice. He peeled off most of the hairy bits and got to work making it look a bit more like him. He realized after some time he'd done the same with the angels. "First idea is always the best one," he declared, but inside his head, where no one else could get at it. "I'll go one better than angels," he thought, as he began adding extras and twiddly bits to his creation. "First of all, I shall give it genitals, so it fits in with the other creations of today." He made a mental note to prepare a second one, for it to share its genitals with, without ever considering the long-term repercussions of this. He gave it the power of speech, so it could tell him, "Thank you." It would say, "Cor, blimey, God, you ain't half excellent. Crikey, oh, blimey, I can't believe you are so brilliant. Where would you like your supper pudding?" It would be better than the angels because of that, he reckoned. He'd need to give it wings, he knew, or the angels would probably get jealous and kill them all. Typical nasty angels. Fucking Lucifer, he thought, rather cruelly. So he turned to whisper to the wingman, who, when last he'd looked, had been working at a furious pace. And he looked down then to see the man quite dead. Atop him sat two of his jet-black creations, already pecking at his eyes. The poor fellow had worked himself quite to death, making all sorts of dreadful things. He had worked so hard that his last batch could not even fly. A chicken? Besides it, a chicken-like creature that's legs and neck seemed entirely too long. They stared at God, awaiting instruction. God cleared his throat and checked his watch. It was nearly time for bed. Gently, he kicked the wingman under the table. Behold, he cried as a distraction. Man! The angels did not clap. The thing on the table sat up and looked at them all. Who are you? It said. The other creatures had only squawked or barked or chirped. The angels were aghast. I am God, said God. Funny sort of a name, said the man. God reasoned this not to be true. It was the first name and therefore perfectly fine. Can I go now? Said the man. Only I've got this thing stuck on the front of me and for some reason I have an unbearable urge to just stick it everywhere possible. God grimaced, but he had to save face. Yes, my child, I will send you now to a lovely garden where you can frolic and play, and I'll send my favorite angel down to keep an eye on you. Lucifer, he called, take this human down to the earth place and watch that he doesn't eat any of the truly scrumptious, brilliant, best thing ever, even better than putting your willy in things, apples down there, or there'll be big trouble. Lovely, thought God. Lucifer will get punished, and the human, well, he'd punish him too, he thought, because he liked being a bit of a bastard. On the seventh day, God rested. I also write historical fiction.
So, like, if you don't mind, if I jump in here pretty quickly, I feel like you took a lot of like the Greek pantheon there and just worked it into like the Old Testament version of God, and that's a fun way to do it.
Yeah, I think you're going to have one. It's got to have all the bits of the others, isn't it?
Oh. It was definitely very, very British in his style of humor also.
Yes, yeah.
I can only apologize.
Yeah.
I did write down Monty Python, so I think we're on a similar wavelength there.
Yeah.
The God voice in particular was very Holy Grail.
Yes. I thought, you're right. Oh, bugger.
No, it's great. I think it's great. It was sort of somewhere between Monty Python and Douglas Adams with the sort of celestial space stuff that was happening as well.
Yeah.
I think you must have written about 5 stories over the last few years about chimps, and when you said, but you know, using the basic frame of a chimp and hoping nobody would notice, I fully lost it. I was laughing my ass off.
Good.
Really, really fun. It was obviously super irreverent, and as you say, yeah, I know. But really, like, a lot of fun, and it was, you know, well structured. It was one of the oldest structures of stories, in fact, 7-part story. But yeah, the turns of phrase were fantastic. The Diamond Rain nonsense sphere was great. This idea of turning the light off because the sun's too bright, and he doesn't, you know, he wants to pretend that he always meant that.
Yeah.
It's really good. But I think the strongest bit for me was all the stuff about the sort of ridiculous taxonomies of the creatures, because that was just really funny. That was basically like bordering on a stand-up set about how stupid some animals' names are.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I actually thought you were going to go further with the bird gag. You know, you're talking about what was it, the blue-footed tit, and I thought you were going to go into, you know, boobies and peckers and all kinds of different birds.
Oh, if I'd had more words, it would have happened, believe me.
Yeah.
It's like, there's a lot of knob gags in the animal kingdom, aren't there?
Yeah.
On the primary orb.
The primary orb.
For which the blue bit only goes so far.
I love the idea of him being slapshod.
Yeah.
He's got a load of yes men with him who are like, oh yeah, brilliant. He's, yeah. One guy's like, I don't know. Right, that's it. Fuck you. You're done.
You're done.
You're out of favor. that little through line, I really enjoy the little through line of each time anyone's doing something, it's like, yeah, but it's, oh God, it's Lucifer. It's definitely Lucifer's fault. Because I've met people like that.
Yeah.
You get it in the office quite a lot. They're like, oh God, we're so busy today. I bet it's because insert name isn't doing their fucking job. You know, nothing to do with them. What's wrong with you?
So, I wonder what would happen if you were put into a classroom and you told this story to a group of primary school, like young primary school kids.
I'd probably end up on a list.
I think you'd be on several lists, potentially. I don't think you'd work as a teacher again.
What are you?
Well, hold on. It's not too hard to work as a teacher. people don't do a lot of reading anymore. You can just kind of throw some stuff out there; they won't notice.
do you in your professional career? Do you find that you are really pushing in a way that other teachers aren't? I'm not saying necessarily at your school or anything like that, but like as a general rule, is there just a regression of education?
I don't know about that. I mean, in terms of schools, like schools are a very complicated subject to begin with. I mean, like I have a lot of hobbies and do a lot of things, and I am very lucky to be able to do that and have a wonderful wife that supports that. But you know, I also don't have things like kids, so I can pursue those things and, you know, and I have the time to do them. But, you know, I think that teachers are mostly trying their best and the kids are too. But there's, you know, definitely a lot of societal changes in the last 20 or 30 years that make education a difficult and tricky field.
Yeah. Do you dry test your stories on your pupils or students?
I thought about doing stuff like that from time to time. But the vast majority of my content doesn't fit things that I teach. I did a video, maybe 8-9 months ago on a conflict called the Yemisi War that I only even knew existed because it was part of the standards I had to teach. So I had to learn the story pretty well. Oh. But outside of that, not much. I'm teaching ancient world history again this year. So maybe my second video ever. It's not very good. I wouldn't go back and watch it. I did one on the Greek creation myth. That's where I got that from. And actually, when you were telling your story, I was thinking back to that. And, you know, just how much of your version of God felt like Zeus to me.
Very Zeus.
Yes.
I've just got sort of amalgamated God thing going, haven't I?
Yeah, sort of like a little bit capricious, a little bit sort of, just sort of careless in the way that he uses his power. Yeah, no, very much so. I do have a bit of a follow-up question there. So obviously, I know that you're very open about the fact on your channel that you sort of go wherever your passions lead you and you know, you put together a lot of... Native American videos recently. How much of that stuff is taught in American schools at middle school?
So that is, I would say, increasingly less. Native American history is like schools really struggle with controversial topics. And when you take a look at American history in general, there is a number of things that we don't really have to be proud of. And Native American or interaction with Native Americans is definitely one of them, you get different ends of the spectrum on that argument. And if you ever go through any of the comments on my YouTube channel, you'll see that a ton. But in reality, it's You know, you had a mass dying of the indigenous population. And it's one of the things that, although it's taught, going in depth on it is tricky to do. There would have to be like separate courses on Native American history all by itself, but it's right. treated, I think, more often like an aside, you know, where you kind of, you know, you see some of the initial contacts, you see that, what we call the Columbian Exchange, where the diseases wind up killing a massive portion of the native population. And then in a lot of the way American history is taught, it kind of goes away until you get to Andrew Jackson and the Trail of Tears. You see some stuff with the Indian Wars in the, you know, 1850s through the 1870s. And outside of that, it's kind of ignored.
Oh, that's absolutely fascinating, because it's clearly it's such a big part of you know, the foundation of America.
It's also really hard to wrap up in any sort of bow. Like, you're dealing with you're not dealing with like a country or a government. You're dealing with very, very, I don't want to call them isolated, but you're dealing with different groups with very different institutions than what we typically think of when we think of things like governments. And then trying to compare those to American institutions, it's a very complex job, and you know, and it's difficult to do in a school level in a way that doesn't you know, make people uncomfortable.
Yeah, and it, you know, even inside the different Native American tribes, like I really particularly enjoyed your video about the way that the Apache initially treated the Comanche, and then the sort of reversal of fortunes. It's just absolutely fascinates me. I mean, we should note at this point that you can obviously access all of Miles's videos on YouTube at Dates and Dead Guys, and I would thoroughly recommend that you do so, because they're excellent.
I mean, in terms of guests giving stories, if you enjoyed that one, you've got so much you can go and get into, guys. Enough to get you through to the interview, I reckon.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of The Tiny Bookcase.
Remember to subscribe, otherwise you're going to miss out on the future fun.
Also, tell a friend. If you like this episode, link them to it.
We'd be tremendously grateful. You can follow us on Twitter at BookcaseTiny, Facebook at The Tiny Bookcase, and Instagram at BookcaseTiny for updates. Speaking of supporting the podcast, well, magic can only take one so far. The Tiny Bookcase is supported by the generosity of its patrons. Those kind souls have really kept my belly full the last year. Let's cast a spell for them, shall we? For magnificent beardery, let's cast the Chinicus Folliculari spell on Gary Laird. For rich ginger tones on their scalp, let us cast the Orangi Hedondo spell for Scott Byrne. And for general fabulousness, why not the Ooh La La How's Your Mother spell on Matthew McLaren?
How do you come up with that shit, man?